Start.
Well, the idea I think with AgPro was that at the time the Saskatchewan wheat pool was just starting to undergo a very significant rationalisation of their country elevator network, and they had purchased a number of facilities from Elders Grain. The main centrepiece of that was the large old government elevator in Saskatoon, and they'd also purchased from another company in Canada the same style of facility did I say Saskatoon?
That's fine.
How about we just erase? And I'll start.
Unfortunately, I don't know how.
Oh, okay.
To erase.
Can you edit?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll just pick that up again. I think they thought that they wanted to just start on the rationalisation of their very extensive and old elevator network. I can't remember how many elevators they had, particularly in Saskatchewan at the time. What they purchased from Elders was the large ex-government elevator in Moose Jaw, and they also purchased from another company the same sister facility in Saskatoon. And so they thought that these were so different to anything else that they had purchased that they would set them up under a separate subsidiary, which wasn't dependent on the same level of elevator network that they had. I think, you know, part of the strategy was to draw grain so that they could rationalise some of the smaller elevator network in the surrounding districts. They also wanted to have a vehicle for other business that they were thinking of doing, and they eventually put fertiliser outlets under that business and other not necessarily related businesses under the AgPro label. AgPro is now pretty much gone from the country. Viterra has labelled everything with the Viterra label, and that's understandable. But I think at the time it served quite a useful purpose, differentiating that style of operation, which was the large inland terminal operation, from the smaller country elevator.
Those elevators, by the way, are part of C.D. Howe's initial elevator construction, the first one being in Thunder Bay. And I think there may have been five in total built. And I think they may almost be exactly the same.
Probably, yeah.
Floor plan.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see they were still in use.
Still in use today.
Yeah. I don't know when the best time to ask the questions about your view of similarities and differences between the grain trade as practiced in Australia versus how you've come to see it practiced in Canada. Would this be a good time for you to comment on that?
Fine. I can give you some my thoughts and perspectives on that. The Australian grain trade typically was characterised by mostly large government and cooperative built regional storage and handling monopolies in the states, in each state of Australia. And these were generally quite good and large facilities that are mostly still in existence, apart from where there's been a necessary rationalisation. But in each state, or like your provinces here, there was an infrastructure built, country and port, and it was either built by government or semi-government grain elevator companies, or in a couple of instances, Western Australia and South Australia, large grower cooperatives. And they basically dominated the handling and storage landscape, so there was no real additional handling facilities at all in the country farmers would harvest their wheat in particular and take it directly off the combine to the storage facilities in the country. Very little on-farm storage. You might have to deliver over a short period of time, but generally you got your deliveries in not long after harvest had finished, except in a very large year, when in any case the central storage system would construct very large outdoor grain pads to deliver grain onto from farm. That's quite different to the Canadian situation, where it didn't have a massive amount of elevator total storage capacity, and on-farm storage was more the norm straight off the harvest. Recognising that the Australian harvest is, for the wheat harvest, is being harvested into the summer. So the longer you go, generally, the more elongated harvest is. It's not as desperate a time as in Canada, because it just gets drier. And so the grain is typically at a much drier level, moisture level coming off the harvest than it is in Canada. And in typical Australian sort of fashion, the Australians are not as worried about getting their harvest off as you would be in Canada with a very short window.
Do they have the same extent of drying equipment then, or they just never have needed it?
There is drying equipment in Australia for those odd years, but it's much harder to come by. Mostly you wait until the grain is at the right moisture, and then you just start your harvest. And the harvest in Australia tends to go from north to south on the east coast, a bit like in the US. So it starts in the northern part of the grain belt and goes to the southern part of Australia and Victoria. And through that time, the grain is drying and summer is coming on. The other characteristic in Australia is that there were less options for growing in the main. Most farmers in Australia have fewer options, or had fewer options, before probably canola came along, than probably in Canada. Much more emphasis here, other than wheat, on barley and special crops, whereas in Australia, barley was certainly a well-grown crop, but the special crop aspect was nowhere near as prevalent as I saw it in the 80s in Canada. So there's some quite big differences. In Canada, there were always the large, early on in the piece, there were the large grower cooperatives, the three prairie pools, and a number of private grain companies, and very, very few public grain companies. In Australia, we had the Australian Wheat Board, similar to the Canadian Wheat Board, but the actual remainder of the grain companies was quite small by comparison, because mostly farmers grew wheat or barley, and the barley up until the 90s, into the mid 90s, was generally also controlled by state barley boards, which had acquisition rights. And there was less of the private grain trade in Australia than I saw when I came to Canada. So there's some quite big differences, really, when you look at both industries. We're both competitors in the wheat side of things, with good quality wheat, but we had tended to be in different markets, just because of the types of wheat we had grown. And the protein levels and so forth, country to country, we tended to be in different markets. Australia was much more heavily, with its lower protein wheats, much more involved in Asian noodle markets and so forth than Canada was. Canada was much more in the high quality bread markets. Australian wheat, being a white wheat, was more suited to some markets than the Canadian wheat, which is a red rhizome wheat. So We were in a sense the two countries, in a sense, were in a way slightly complementary rather than being major competitors. Although I know that we were major competitors in the wheat market in countries like China in the days when China was really kicking off their main wheat purchases.
You mentioned the wheat board in Australia. Did they always have a wheat board? Was it
similar time frames to the wheat board in Canada? It was probably introduced for similar reasons. It was a relatively old institution in Australia, like it has been in Canada. The ideas about changes to the wheat board were not as political in Australia as they seem to always have been in Canada and remain in Canada to be. But one thing that did happen in Australia was that in the early 90s, the wheat board in Australia decided that, I think with the government and with the farmer organisations, decided that some of their practices may be unsustainable going forward. Government guarantees, for instance, on borrowings. The single desk for the Australian domestic market, which is really an island market. And so they made changes to the wheat board in Australia, right, going back, starting in the early 90s, that meant that it was a sort of steady path of change that eventually led to deregulation entirely a few years ago. But there was much more of an industry discussion about that, or constructive discussion about that at the time, rather than about what would be the best way forward, rather than, I suppose, what I've seen of the Canadian situation, which seems to be more about entrenched ideological positions.
So is the wheat board in Australia no longer in existence, or does it continue as a voluntary?
Yeah, the wheat board in Australia is now a wheat board in Australia became a publicly listed company. It went into other business areas, and basically after the scandal associated with the Iraq food for oil scandal. Where the Australian Wheat Board was heavily caught up in payments to the old Saddam regime, that it was decided that wheat should be deregulated. And so wheat was actually, the whole business was deregulated. The Australian Wheat Board today has just been purchased as a public company. It was acquired last year by Agrium from Canada, and their grain business, I think, is just in the process of being sold to Cargill.
If I have this right, and correct me if I'm wrong, the wheat board or the wheat delivery system in Australia was set up as a government function. And they would have fed into the wheat board. So when the wheat board was, I'll call it deregulated, what surfaced then to take up the slack?
Well before that, in the early 90s, the grain handling systems on the East Coast, which had been sort of semi-government built facilities, were substantially given back to farmers and formed into grain handling companies. In Queensland, in New South Wales, and in Victoria, those facilities were was recognised that farmers had actually paid through their handling and storage charges for those facilities over a long period of time. Governments actually wanted to get out of the business of being involved in these facilities. So arrangements were agreed that they would basically either be sold to or given back to farmers. And farmer companies were formed. They were generally not cooperatives, they were generally public companies, but they had farmer ownership. So I actually went back from Canada after the SAST wheat pool days in the early 90s to run the newly forming Queensland version of these, which was a company we decided to call GrainCo, which was basically putting the grain handling facilities in Queensland together with the then barley board, state barley board and sorghum marketing board, and actually another organisation called the State Wheat Board, which ran seed and crop insurance. And we formed a grower company out of that and gave the farmers shareholding. And in New South Wales, around about the same time, the government put its handling facilities up for sale, and a grower organisation in New South Wales purchased that and formed the company, which is still in existence, called GrainCorp. And in Victoria, a similar thing happened. GrainCorp now, back in the early 2000s, GrainCorp finally purchased or acquired the Queensland company, GrainCo, and now owns all of the East Coast handling facilities. The handling facilities in Western Australia, which is about 40% of Australia's wheat crop, nowadays, were built by a grower cooperative bulk handling in Western Australia. It was always a grower cooperative. It is still a cooperative, not a company. And in South Australia, a grower cooperative was formed, cooperative bulk handling. Eventually, that company changed its nature and is now owned by Viterra. That's the acquisition that Viterra made a couple of years ago in Australia, and that's basically the South Australian handling assets. So all of those things, all of those changes were happening through the 90s to change the nature of those businesses into more from a government owned or from the old cooperative style to more modern style ownership structures, generally farmers being owners, and they also got into, rather than just grain handling, they got into other businesses and grain trading.
How does a company set up that is producer owned? Can the owners not sell their shares and then over time, the company is not owned by the producers? Yeah. Is that a concern or just inevitable?
I think if you get into the very standard and rigid cooperative style ownership, then that probably means that it could stay that way for a very long time. But when you form a company structure and you have shareholdings, and you also need to think about growth and need for capital. Invariably, this happened in Australia with a number of these companies and actually the AWB Limited, that outside equity is brought in from the marketplace, new classes of shares are created, they're more publicly traded. Eventually, growers look at that and say, why can't I benefit in the value that is there in my shares? And eventually those shares are listed as well. And unless you have a non-market type structure where there's some sort of residual shareholding or voting shares in farmers' hands, invariably it seems that those structures, if they want to change, want to grow, rather than just through normal cash flow growth, normal equity growth, they need to get extra capital, so they tend to you tend to water down grower shareholding in those companies.
Has there been any perceptible change at the farm level with all of these changes, or does life go on, crops get grown, crops get harvested?
Yeah, life goes on, farmers adapt, crops are being grown, Australian wheat industry is vibrant. There's been probably a shift away from the old wheat sheep farms in Australia, which were probably limited to the amount of grain they grew because they had sheep, large sheep holdings on them as well, to more, in the more reliable areas, just grain growing areas. So wheat acreage is actually on the increase in Australia. Yes, there's lots of questions about price discovery and all those things, but farmers do have a lot of choice nowadays in Australia in terms of who they sell to.
So we started talking about the sort of similarities and differences within the Canadian system from your perspective from the outside. Are there any other things that come to your mind and also about the Australian view of Canada as a trade? I know competitor might be a little strong. Anything that
I think like there's been quite a lot of interaction between Australia and Canada over a long period of time, and the US for that matter as well. It's a different growing cycle because of it being basically more of a spring wheat situation here, whereas Australia is really a winter planted wheat. There's been with variety changes and changes in customer preferences. There's been more of a competitive element come into the environment, whereas now Australia would be seen as, and Canada would be seen, and the US for that matter, would be seen as major competitors in quite a number of markets, particularly when you get into the Asian markets area. Of course, through this time, we've also seen major shifts in some of the customer base as well. So China's gone from being a large importer, to a self-sufficient status, pretty much, really only buying specialty wheats or wheat in bulk in large quantities as they have a poor season. But in the last few years, being almost having the ability to export, we've seen Russia go from a large importer of wheat to a large exporter of wheat in most years, the last couple of years aside. And so so there's been some fairly dramatic changes in the customer base, and this has meant that all of the main competitor suppliers, Australia, the US, Canada, to some extent other countries like Argentina, have had to look at the products that they are producing, the types of wheat they are producing, and really pay a lot of attention to what is becoming a much more sophisticated requirement from customers. And so competition, I think, has increased rather than anything else in this time. And so it's meant that where Australia, In days gone by, when the Australian Wheat Board and the Canadian Wheat Board were in a sense counterparts, while they wouldn't have colluded, they would have been friendly competitors in a way. This is my view. Probably some ex-commissioners of the Wheat Board mightn't have that view, but we're in a very competitive situation today in the world marketplace.
The history of competition between Canada and the U.S. has not been a pretty one when it comes to grain marketing. Mm. So was Australia ever part of, you know, bringing Canada to the, whatever the court is?
WTO.
The W.
No, that's mainly a cross-border issue between the U.S. and Canada. And the philosophical view within the US that seems to be, have been anyway, there that that somehow the Canadian Wheat Board was not abiding by the same rules, was not commercial, was being subsidised, was being given a free run by its government in a number of areas. And of course, every challenge they have brought in the WTO, they haven't won. The Canadian Wheat Board has won. And that has just gone to show that the Canadian Wheat Board does live by very normal commercial practices. The government guarantee on borrowings, which does give a lower cost of interest to farmers here. The actual sales by the CWB are really just like a cooperative selling, collective selling mechanism, rather than being some market distorting mechanism. And the Australians, of course, always up until fairly recently had a regulated wheat market in any case. So we were probably on the same side of the WTO up until fairly recently on this issue.
To your knowledge, did the states ever bring Australia, who, from what you're saying, was operating under essentially the same and perhaps even more government control, never brought them forward?
I don't know for sure, actually, but I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. So the cross-border
issue. It was more about the cross-border issue,
Interesting. So we've left your career. You went back to Australia.
Yeah.
And now you're here again. So how did your career progress?
Well, I was in Australia with this company called GrainCo for about 5 or 6 years, and I had then a series of jobs. I was asked to go and run a baking and flour milling company in Australia, a publicly traded company called Defiance Mills, which I did, and as their managing director. And that company was actually taken over by Bunge, and after a settling in period with Bunge, I left the company and immediately went to work for a company called Queensland Cotton, which was a cotton trading and cotton ginning processing company. They bought a business in North America, in California and Arizona, and they needed help to sort out a number of business issues, and so I came on board as their, I suppose, their chief operating officer, but also the president of their North American business. And so I was involved in that for a little while, lived in California, and for about 15 months. And then I was headhunted to go back to Australia to head up a newly forming single desk marketing organisation in the sugar industry in Australia called Queensland Sugar. And it probably wasn't called Queensland Sugar then. It was called the Queensland Sugar Marketing Commission or something like that. And it formed into an industry-owned marketing company. And I was actually the managing director and chief executive of that company until I came to the Canadian Wheat Board. I was there for about 8 years, and in that time we marketed all of the raw sugar produced in Australia, mainly in Queensland, and internationally and domestically. Went through a deregulation of the domestic market, sales market, and then a full deregulation of the business. And reformed, renegotiated sales contracts with the industry to become basically the voluntary single seller or main single seller of raw sugar out of Australia, which they still are today.
So it must have been the weather of Winnipeg that attracted you.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what it was. I knew how bad it was in Winnipeg in terms of weather. But, you know, we're sitting in Winnipeg today doing this interview, and if you ask people from around the world, do they know much about Winnipeg, the answer is probably not much. And so I think my wife didn't know very much about it But I was attracted to this job because I'd done a lot, I thought, to help facilitate a conversation about the future of the marketing organisation at Queensland Sugar. And for different reasons, entirely to reasons here that might be prevalent here, we decided on a course of action. And I thought that, and I think that probably the selection committee might have thought as well, that my experience over a fairly long career, but also being involved in some organisations like this might be useful. Whether that's the case or not, we'll have to tell when I finally retire. But you know, when you look at the Canadian Wheat Board, politics aside, it is a very significant business, and you know, 20 million tonnes approximately of sales a year, the largest individual seller of wheat in the world, with what is a fantastic customer base. I was attracted to the business part of the Wheat Board rather than anything else.
You came in at a very tough time too.
Yeah, I think they'd been through some very difficult times with the fact that my position is at the government's pleasure, and so we're the CEO of the Wheat Board, the president of the Wheat Board is a public appointment. It's appointed by the government, and there had been some significant difficulties associated with that over the some previous couple of years, and so I knew in part, I suppose, from a distance what had been happening, and I suppose I didn't say no, and yeah. So I kept on going with the process, but. And we had to make a decision in the end whether to come to Winnipeg or not. Mm-hmm. But from my point of view, it's been a very interesting exercise.
Are there things you know about the Canadian Wheat Board now that you didn't know before? And I'm not talking politics now. I'm talking more about what they do in general. You can comment on the politics if you want, but I can understand if you wouldn't.
Yeah. No, I won't be commenting on the politics, but only to say that, you know, there are polarised views about the Wheat Board. Mm-hmm. I did know that it was a very substantial business. I knew that they must have a very good methodology because they've been in existence a long period of time. I didn't understand, and I've learnt a lot about, the wheats, and the varieties of wheat and the uses of the various varieties we have to market in, or to grown by the farmers in Canada, and therefore to market. I think I've been very pleased with the internal processes at the Wheat Board, the depth and the strength of our marketing team, and the relationships long-standing relationships we have. The use of the Canadian International Grain Institute in terms of technical advice to customers every season on the quality of grain that we are growing and how best to use that is a major advantage to us in terms of a marketing package here that I was not really aware of much at all. I would have expected that there would have been technical advice, but I didn't understand that we had such a good organisation in SIGI. The situation with the grain trade and the Wheat Board, and the way the individual grain companies and the Wheat Board work together, basically, to collect the grain in the country and deliver it to port, was something that I was not as fully versed in as I am obviously now, and And there's obviously a need for the wheat board and the grain companies to work very, very closely together on that. And interestingly enough, on the international marketing as well, because those companies are generally all involved in, to some extent, in some part of our sales, of parts of our sales as well, to customers as accredited exporters.
Does that, the accredited exporters, do wheat board staff meet with the private company marketing staff on a regular basis? Do they have an organization, for example, that...
With regard to marketing, no. We would meet with there is obviously a grain and elevators association, and we would meet with those formally on in terms of grain elevator issues. We tend to be also meeting with individual companies more and more these days in terms of grain elevator issues and port terminal issues as well. We just work individually on the sales side with companies and customers. It's a sort of three part sort of discussion. The Australian Wheat Board staff are very regularly in touch with the customers themselves. They're also very regularly in touch with some of the companies who have customers. And so in terms of price negotiations and those sort of things, it's a sort of three-way arrangement for some of our sales. Some of the sales are obviously made direct to customers, but there is actually quite a close working relationship between the grain companies in Canada and the Wheat Board on a whole range of aspects of wheat marketing. There's probably not widely sort of known or appreciated.
Is it possible for you to describe a typical day on the job?
It's probably not, because I have a very, I've got to say I'm fortunate enough to have a very varied life at the Wheat Board. We do have very structured and regular meetings around risk management and around financial risk. And those are scheduled regularly. I'm fortunate to have my executive team just in offices close by, and so discussions actually take place between our offices more than anything else. We do have formal management meetings, but my typical day would be to, if I'm in Winnipeg, would be to. I would tend to have a number of meetings on during the day that have been organised internally. There might be some external meetings with the grain companies, the Grains Council, or organisations that I've been asked to meet with. I try to keep an eye on what the markets are doing. And although that's not my job, we have a very good team in our futures area, but I try to keep abreast of what's happening in the marketing area. I would have, on a daily basis, I would probably talk very often to our chief operating officer, Ward Wisensell, and maybe some of his staff, and our chief financial officer, Britta Chell, about sales, marketing, grower programs, etc. I tend to get involved at the higher and hopefully strategic level, not the operational level so much. Relationships with senior people from the grain companies, the rail companies, banks, auditors, directors, and grower stakeholder groups, it would all be normal for me to do on a daily or weekly basis. Because I'm the sole employee, if you like, of the board of directors, I would most days talk to our chairman, who is a grower, or other directors who might call in about anything they want to talk about associated with the operation of the board. So it's hard for me to describe a typical day. I have quite a varied life, but in terms of management, there's many aspects to the business that I try and keep my tabs on. And I've got to say I'm very fortunate to have a management team that will keep me very well informed as well. So I don't have to go looking too far. Normally the issues are brought to me.
I think you've answered, at least in part, the next set of questions, which have to do with asking you to describe the interconnectedness of the Canadian Wheat Board with other major components of the industry. I think you just finished speaking about the interconnectedness with grain companies. Mm-hmm. Would you have a couple comments to make about, and this almost seems brainless, the connectedness with the producers?
Yep. And I could also talk a little bit about some of the other stakeholders, if you
like. Okay, well, you have the list there, so maybe you can just go through it.
So one of the things that the Wheat Board has been trying to do ever since it's the change from being a commissioner structure to being to one of shared governance with elected and appointed board of directors in 1999, we've been trying to turn the business back towards the farmer. And in the last couple of years, we've actually probably for the first time put together a strategic plan, which really is about configuring the business to deliver value to farmers. There's a lot of aspects to that. One of them is operating as efficiently and effectively as you can, offering farmers the best suite of marketing programs you can, having a good, viable customer base that you know in depth and to buy the product, and then looking at what is the future of the organisation in terms of growth or what have you. And all of this is really, from our perspective at the Wheat Board, about delivering value to farmers. So we've coined some phrases to try and push the culture of the organisation more towards farmers. So we talk about being farmer first in the organisation. And I think we do have a very high engagement of staff with regard to this whole idea being out there for the producers. We probably see ourselves, even though we're not owned by farmers, we see ourselves as like being owned by farmers. But that's particularly because we have 10 of our directors who are elected by farmers. So we see it as our role to be providing farmers with a lot more information than maybe we used to, providing them with programs and services in the marketing area that are as flexible and meeting their business needs as possible, rather than just running a pool. And in doing that, I'm not downplaying the importance of the pool. Most grain still goes into the pool, but we have a staff of field officers, which we call farm business representatives, who are out in the country. We have some other staff that go out into the country regularly and run grower meetings, information meetings, etc. And we encourage all of our senior management and staff to get involved in farmer meetings as much as possible. So we do have a very significant turning back of the organisation, if you like, towards farmers, which I think is really the right thing to do, and and the best thing for the future of the organisation anyway. In terms of we've talked about some of the grain companies, but we do have a lot of business interaction with the rail companies and with the inland shipping companies, the Laker companies, from Thunder Bay through to the Seaway, because these are necessary components of the logistical chain to market. And while we do have sometimes some fairly tough negotiations with these companies on rates, we do also have good relationships with them because we have to work closely with them to make sure that the product is moved. The Canadian Grain Commission is a very worthwhile and necessary part of the sales package, in my view, because they are the independent attestation to quality. And so if you can have their seal of quality on your product when you're selling to a customer, that's something that other nations or other of our competitors don't have. And so in my view, it's one of the good and necessary parts of what I would think is a unique marketing package that we have in Canada, particularly for wheat. We get involved in the research side of the business as well because of trying to translate back to the research end what the market is saying and the market requirements. And I think we have always and will want to continue being very much a part of that research plant breeding discussion that goes on to ensure that we're forecasting the market requirements successfully enough so that farmers get to plant wheats that are going to be in demand in the world. There's a debate around high quality versus lower quality, yield versus higher price, and that's always a good debate to be having, to be deciding on, well, are we doing the right thing? Are we allowing farmers to make the best possible gross margins on their farms as possible? We've seen the competition of canola, for instance, come in with genetically modified canola that is actually making significant gains in terms of yield. And we've seen the acreage of canola increasing and the demand for canola increasing. And so we've seen a reduction in wheat acres over a period of time because of that. And I'm very keen to see wheat do as best as it possibly can from a farmer perspective. And that means getting them the best possible returns for the wheats that they could grow. And so research is also an important part of that.
You may not be the person to ask this, but are there current issues with wheat, that research issues that the board is involved in?
There's a number of aspects in terms of wheat quality that, for instance, we're involved in. We probably would say that given that we're not the largest producer of wheat in the world, we are a significant exporter, however. Most customers buy Canadian wheat or high-quality Canadian wheat to upgrade the quality of their flour. So I think it's important for us to stay at that niche quality end. I see Canadian wheat production actually as a niche crop in a sense rather than anything else. However, I think we have some very specific issues, fusarium being one. That we need to be looking to breed out of as much as possible. I think the researchers have done a very good job over the years in keeping the quality very good of the wheats that we have available and combating various of the diseases that could come into the wheats in terms of blights and leaf diseases, etc. However, I see the fusarium issue as being one that we have to be very careful of going forward, and there will be other microtoxins and so forth that we also have to deal with. So these are all components of breeding that need mm-hmm. to be thought of very closely as we go forward.
Is there a position within the wheat board that coordinates the board's concerns about research?
Yeah. We have a number of technical people within the wheat board who are basically working with the marketing end to try and bring those sort of those ideas through. We have a number of those people on all of the research main research committees, industry committees, as well as some of our directors. So we do have a reasonable presence in that area.
What is your sense of the role that the Canadian Wheat Board played in Canada's success as an international grain trader?
I think the ability, you know, and this is. Please don't get me wrong. This is not necessarily a plug for the single desk so much, mm-hmm. but because the Wheat Board has had. The ability to administer the single desk. There have been some that has created the opportunity to deal with customers on a different level than a trader. And I'm not sure I'm answering your question well enough here.
Well, say, just to expand on that, I think I know what you're saying, but I'm just interpreting. So what do you mean by that?
So the Wheat Board does have the ability to have all of the wheat production for domestic and export use in its hands. And that's a very significant advantage in a cooperative marketing sense, when you're dealing with customers who require constant supply or who require certain qualities of product. You can use that system successfully, and I think the Wheat Board has used it very successfully to provide customers with what they want, sort of when they want it. And that's quite a difference, I think, to how a grain trader would approach it. It's given the opportunity for Canada to develop very, very close relationships with customers in a variety of countries and convince them that the Canadian product is the best quality. I think there's been some real opportunities that developed in Japan, in pasta markets, in some of the more high quality bread markets for Canadian product because of that. So to that extent, I think the Wheat Board has become quite a successful marketer. I wouldn't call the Wheat Board a trader because the Wheat Board doesn't trade grain so much, buy and sell grain. The Wheat Board basically markets grain. And I think there's a big difference between marketing and trading in that sense. Marketing encompasses a lot of things, market development, branding of the product, etc., than simple trading does. And so the Wheat Board has had that opportunity to develop a Canadian brand. Mm-hmm. And these are things that you might not otherwise be able to do if you didn't have an organisation, say, like the Wheat Board. Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying is reinforced by a lot of what we've heard from other people during their interviews, that a lot of the success in this business, and it may not just be on Canada's part, but it certainly has been from the Wheat Board and the Grain Commission's international connections, that they've developed very deep connections that go beyond just the commercial
That's right.
Transaction.
Yeah. Yeah, and my view is this comes at a there's a financial cost to that, because this is a more expensive system actually than because of that, because you are spending money on market development, for instance, whereas as a trader you may not spend that money on market development. You mightn't have the margin to spend the money on market development. So one of the balancing acts for our industry and in Canada and for the wheat board for that matter is to make sure that our cost structure is as appropriate as it can be and as lean as it can be, because margins are relatively thin. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, also to demonstrate that it is adding value to farmers for that cost. I'm aware of those sort of tensions and trade-off. But I do think with the Grain Commission, with the Canadian International Grain Institute and with the Wheat Board, we do have actually a fairly unique package. The Wheat Board is spending a little bit of money each year out of the pools for market development and for actual now moving into branding with customers, with the customers of customers, with the public, in terms of branding on packaging, etc. And this is working with customers to sort of put the Canadian seal of quality on their packaging. And we see customers saying that on their retail packs that is helping them. And that is actually creating an even closer bond with those customers to the Canadian product. So, you know, these are things that I think are a bit unique about what we do here in Canada. And, you know, in many respects, whatever happens in the future, you wouldn't like to see those things be lost in terms of endearing the Canadian product to a customer base.
That's what we'd like to hear, endearing. I have questions about major changes that you saw in the industry over your working years. Mm-hmm. And I guess in your case, because you were in Canada and out of Canada and mm-hmm. back into Canada again, so what major changes did you see, and what do you think were the impacts of these changes?
I worked in Canada up until 1991, and then I came back in 2008. And so I saw some very, very significant changes. When I left Canada in the early 90s, we still had a very extensive network, large network of country elevators. The whole rejuvenation of the elevator network, the building of the concrete elevators, the closing down of a lot of the small elevators, to the chagrin, I know, of a lot of people, but on the other hand, I would say a more efficient industry was very, very apparent, and that would probably be the major change that I saw when I came back to the industry here. It is an industry that we now relies on a very, very thin sort of storage pipeline system. If you can get my drift on that, I mean, farmers probably put in that same time period more on farm storage, and the elevator system is more of a throughput, country elevator system is more of a throughput system than a storage system, and very, very timely shipment to port, and a lot of planning is therefore needed to make sure that you can meet shipments as they come in with the right quality, because the pipeline and the storage system is quite thin. And if you make a mistake in that and you send the wrong quality, you draw the wrong qualities from farms and you send the wrong qualities to port, you can get yourself into some serious supply chain difficulties. So the other thing that I've noticed is that the detail involved in planning of logistics is something that is probably far more important today than it was back in earlier times.
Mm-hmm. That brings to mind two things that related to it, one that doesn't seem to have changed over time, and the other that is a change, just a recent change for you. The rail system at the same time as the country elevators were decreasing in number, the rail lines and rail shipping points.
Yeah.
And there always seems to be a balancing act between you as a major shipper and any of the grain shippers and the rail companies. So do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, you're right that I didn't mention the rail network rationalisation. That's been major as well. That's basically followed the other, the elevator rationalisation. And we now see also, we've seen some of those rail lines purchased back by farmer groups. And who are running those either on producer cars or their own sort of loading points. There is a fine balance that goes on between the rail companies, ourselves, and the grain companies. And that, in my view, this requires, as I said, a lot of planning, but it also requires a lot of communication between the rail companies, the grain companies, and ourselves, so that we are in sync as much as possible. There are issues, of course, and some of them mightn't easily be solved, but those aside, one of the things that I have been trying to do in the last couple of years is sit down with the grain companies at a senior management level and work through what it is we have to do to work more successfully together and increase the level of communication between us rather than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing in the world is to have standoffs between some of the grain companies and the wheat board when you're trying to shift 20 million tonnes a year. So from a business perspective, I think we're gaining in success in that area.
And in some of the historical research I've done, some of these things seem to be cyclical, and if somebody doesn't care for them, it slips back into the negative side of the cycle as opposed to the...
Well, I think because you have the natural pressures of the wheat board trying to do its job and trying to actually move grain at the lowest possible cost, and the most, what it might think is the most efficient manner to port, and you have the grain companies operating for their own ends, which are generally the profit of the grain company, there's a natural tension there. Now, that's fine, that's healthy probably, but what we have to do is find the happy medium with regard to that and make sure that we are all sort of pointing in the same direction in terms of this grain movement. And if you don't keep working at it, those tensions will just cause a sort of natural rifts to occur. So part of what I see as my job is to try and keep the communication lines open. And that might mean me just talking with the CEO or the head of one of the grain companies just to where there are problems and difficulties and try to reflect that back into the organisation or sort out the best solution, or it might also be, which is better than that, having the management teams of both organisations sit down and constructively work through the issues and come up with the best solutions.
The second item was the new ships.
Yep.
What that was unique. What brought that into being?
Well, it's unique in a sense that it's a new, we haven't owned ships before. But the wheat board does own 3,600 rail cars. And so the rationale for us at the wheat board was more about being part of, we see ownership of parts of the logistical chain like that as basically part of the exercise of marketing. We're going to be paying Laker Freight, for instance, every year. If we can make an investment that makes a return on that Laker Freight and reduces that as we plan with our business plan on this on that purchase, then that's a that's a plus. We felt, or the directors felt, there are very few things that the wheat board probably can invest in because of the way the Act is constructed. And so our judgment was this was one of the very few things that we could invest in. There was an opportunity there with the potential rejuvenation of the whole Laker fleet, given the reduction of the 25% duty on imported ships, which made the case for building new ships viable, and we felt we could participate in that.
Because I imagine the changes over availability of shipping on the through the seaway system has changed over the years as well, to make it, to take it to the point where there wasn't sufficient.
The fleet was getting very old. It was in need of a lot of refurbishment, and yes, they needed, and environmentally, efficiency wise, for a whole range of aspects, we could see the fleet starting to dwindle, and it's encouraging now that I think there's been quite a number of announcements of new builds coming forward from other companies, the wheat board being the minor part of that. That will mean that we'll have a very viable fleet going forward. Salties, of course, can come through the system, but I think more and more the restrictions on salties are going to be such environmentally and within the lakes that it mightn't be quite as viable in the future, or the restrictions will certainly be fairly great, I think, in the future. And the new style vessels, the Laker vessels being built, will certainly be built with that in mind.
Have you dealt with the challenges to the extent that you would like to? That's the next, because I think a lot of what you've spoken about is challenges.
Yeah. I think we've rambled around a fair bit of that.
Yes. Significant events, anything to add to that?
No. I can't think of
anything. They're all, there's so
many
of them
we've talked about.
Yeah. Is it fair to ask you, at this stage in your career, what you're most proud of?
I suppose
to date, let's say.
So I suppose I've had a fairly long and varied career in agribusiness, and I don't like to sort of think too much about what I might be proud of, because I've just been part of companies that have been involved in trying to do things in the industry and succeed in various parts of agribusiness. I suppose that I suppose I've been a CEO type in companies for now since the late 80s, so that's a long time. And so I suppose what you become is you become a bit of a student of organisations and organisational culture, and organisations at a strategic level. And so I suppose if I'm proud of anything, it would be that I've tried to help companies think about where they're at today, what they might have to do in the future, and how they can improve both internally and externally. And so that's probably what I think I try and do when I come to work every day. And so if I look back in a few years' time, I'll probably hope that I'm not remembered too much from, because I think, you work with teams of people and you just try and make the situation as good as you can in the circumstances you can. But I hope I'm remembered for being one that tried to help organisations succeed and tried to get everybody in the organisation to point in the same direction.
What is the toughest thing that you've ever done? Even if you just deal with in general terms.
Yeah, the toughest things in businesses, some people talk about negotiations they've done and so forth. Yes, I've been involved in quite a lot of tough negotiations. The toughest things in organisations to me are always the people issues. Everybody in an organisation is an individual. Everybody has their own reason for working, their own reason for coming to work every day, And the hardest thing, I think, is to try and get everybody's aspirations when they come to work lined up the same way. And because we're humans, sometimes that alignment is often fickle and doesn't last very long, so you have to keep working at it.
I'm going to ask a couple of specific questions about sort of the history of the grain industry, in particular in Thunder Bay. So have you ever been to Thunder Bay?
I've never been. I have been to Thunder Bay, but not in the last 3 years.
Okay.
I mean to go to Thunder Bay, and I had a conversation with the CEO of the port only a little while ago, and he gave me a computer presentation on the port. But I know I will be going to Thunder Bay in the course of the next little while, because, you know, we are obviously very interested in Thunder Bay as a staging point for our grains, and also what is the I think it's got a good future, but is what is the what are the ways the wheat board will be having to deal in the future in the with all the companies in the port.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there's some work that we have to do with regard to that.
We are, as a group, Friends of Grain Elevators, and this being Voices of the Grain Trade part of it, the Friends of Grain Elevators is trying to interest the federal government in establishing a national historic site to recognize the contribution of the grain industry to Canada's growth and development. So as you see Canadian Wheat Board as being a part of that success, what if such a centre were to happen, what parts of the history of the Wheat Board do you think should be most recognised?
Oh, I think you could it's the first time I've thought about it. So, I mean, I think you could look at the look at the history of grain movement through the area, through there. You could look at the building programs that obviously took place to build the infrastructure that's there. I mean, I think it's arguable that it's a position of fact that the tonnage going through Thunder Bay is less today than it was 50 years ago, and certainly some of the infrastructure was built in for a different era than we have today. So there's the arguable part is to what extent is there overcapacity in Thunder Bay? Back 50 or 60 years ago, the wheat board, its exports was something over 80% to Europe, and so a lot of that went out through Thunder Bay. Today, around 20% of our exports go that way. So that's been a major shift, and so the wheat board, the wheat board's history associated with Thunder Bay is long, and obviously, but it is the shifting of the customer base for Canadian grain that has caused a shift in the fortunes of Thunder Bay as a grain staging point. The wheat board's been a fairly significant part of that. So I would see us being able to tell a lot of stories about that. I would think there would be probably quite a lot of history that we would have, would still probably reside here about that. I suppose the other thing I think is that this is pretty well stabilised now, and I can actually see customers for wheat and durum products in particular in areas that would be serviced by Thunder Bay probably increasing gradually in coming years. So I wouldn't think, people talk about Thunder Bay, I wouldn't think it will go backwards. I think it will actually, in grain terms, it's got the likelihood of going forwards from now, particularly in wheat and durum anyway. So I think that's a good thing. to the extent that the Wheat Board will play a role in Thunder Bay, I think we'll probably have still have a prominent position in Thunder Bay in terms of the future of it, and the future of the grain facilities there going forward. So we'd be very interested in if the thoughts are being put together on this, we'd be very interested in taking part in that.
Excellent. What a wonderful way to end the interview. Thank you so much. I can't believe that we've had an hour and a half.
Okay, neither can I. Sorry. So-